TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Science and Genetic Engineering, Martha Crouch and Ricarda Steinbrecher. Today you will hear from two scientists who gave up their careers in genetic engineering. They fear that genetic engineering of plants might lead to catastrophe because it is based on false assumptions. Dr. Martha Crouch is retired professor of biology at Indiana University in Bloomington. She closed her lab when she realized that her research was being used to develop seeds that are forever sterile, the so-called terminator technology. Such technology forces farmers to buy seeds every year instead of planting saved seeds from the current harvest. Martha Crouch begins with the claims made by the biotech industry.
When I read the literature from the probiotechnology side of science, the first thing that is said in almost every article is this: heck, biotech is just like plant breeding and the kinds of biotechnology that we've been doing for 10,000 years. We've been breeding yeast to make beer and wine. We've been changing corn to have bigger corn cobs and cows to make more milk. It's been a messy process. Over that 10,000 years, we've been able to get the cows to mate with each other, but you know, thousands of genes get transferred every time they mate, and they get all mixed up in the sexual process, and it's messy and not very precise. With genetic engineering, what we can do is identify a specific piece of DNA in any organism on Earth, and we can go in and, with scissors made of enzymes, cut that piece of DNA out of the organism that we've identified it in, and fiddle with it a little bit, and then transfer it over into the chromosome of the cow or the corn plant. And when we put it in there, we know what we're doing. It's not this messy sex business. Have you heard that before? Or read that in the newspapers and heard it on the television? Well, I don't know how they can get away with saying that, because the idea of being able to move DNA between species that never mate in nature is a radically new technology. Never in a billion years would a flounder fish lay down with a tomato plant and mate. And yet now we can move the DNA between those species that have been separated by that evolutionary time period. Also, the idea that if you know the sequence of a gene, you understand all the secrets of life is just ridiculous. I've heard very respected molecular biologists talk that way, and you may have heard it too. Now we understand what it is to be human because we've sequenced the DNA of a human. Does that make sense to you, that we are our DNA? It doesn't even make sense to biologists who are trained classically and understand anything about genetics. Everybody knows that genes act in a context of the environment, in the context of other genes that they're next to and mixed up with, that you can't make a whole organism from the DNA alone, that really organisms are products of their relationships. And it's the relationship between the proteins that are made in response to a gene and all of the other factors in the cosmos, really, that determines what that organism will be. What molecular biologists focus on is what they do know, and it is remarkable that we've been able, with science, to look into the genes and determine the sequence of bases, the code, the letters that make up the DNA. That is remarkable, but it's a tiny pinprick, the tiniest little bit of knowledge about how life works. It's based on the idea that if you understand the DNA, then you can control it and you can engineer life to your expectations, that life organisms are machines, that the machines can be operated by on-off switches, that you can turn genes on and off, up or down, that once you've created the machine, it will do what you think it will do, that organisms are basically like atoms in the 1950s, the idea of billiard balls that are moving through space and occasionally bump into each other but retain their shells, their integrity, rather than being a network of interactions that are constantly exchanging things. And so you have engineers, genetic engineers with their blinders on, thinking that they're controlling life by transferring genes, not only controlling life, but my God, that if you transfer a gene from one organism to another and you've tweaked it a little bit, that you now own that organism, that you can patent it, that somehow you've invented something. The arrogance of that is just unbelievable to me. To me, that is a limited type of view of the world, a limited and faulty view of the world, that when acted upon, particularly in an industrial context, inevitably will lead to unexpected consequences, because the underlying assumptions are simply false. It may work for a little while. You may be able to put an insecticide gene into a corn plant and have it kill insects for a year or two, or maybe 3 or 4 years. But those genes are not going to stay put. They're going to end up moving through the environment, through pollen, through seeds. They're going to end up becoming ineffective as organisms adapt and respond, as insects become resistant, as they change their behavior. I mean, a simple little story, a cotton engineered with BT in the southern part of the United States, an insecticide that was supposed to be made in all the cells of the cotton plants. It turns out that as the season went on, the flower buds didn't make enough of the insecticide to kill the caterpillars they were supposed to be killing. And so caterpillars that normally didn't eat very many flower buds were crawling around on the leaves, spitting out the toxic leaf tissue and testing out the different parts of the plant, and they found that, you know, the flowers tasted a lot better, and so they changed their behavior and they started eating flower buds. And that's a tiny little network. All of the different ramifications of the food chain and the food web with all of these novel products being made in plants. It's a fundamental change in our relationship with the rest of nature. Domestication that has been going on for 10,000 years of the cows and the corn and the yeast and so forth has, by necessity and probably by choice for humans, been a collaboration with our domesticated organisms. We have been in a position where we have been able to choose the variability that already exists in nature and to try and enhance it. So for example, if I was a farmer in southern Mexico, or a person in southern Mexico domesticating corn 10,000 years ago, and there was variability in the size of the corn kernels, that was something that the corn offered up. It was variability present in the corn plant in the first place. And then I would choose the characteristics and foster those corn kernels over others. There's a new book out called The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World by Michael Pollan, where he argues that the domesticated animals and plants, such as corn, maybe manipulating humans as much as humans have manipulated the corn, that the corn plants that were desirable to us, we nurtured, fed, weeded, and so they got us like the bees to move them around, like bees moving pollen, offering up nectar. They offered up a plumper seed so that we'd carry their seeds around and take care of them. And so we're like the bees and the ants and the other animals that interact with the plants. This is a collaboration, a partnership. Our cycle of life, our ability to have healthy children and to look into the future, has depended on the health and the well-being of the corn plants and their cycle of life. And those two things are intertwined almost as if in a marriage for the last 10,000 years. Now, about 100 years ago, after Darwin and the Origin of Species, scientific plant breeding began, where we used more precise methods and tried to fit agriculture into industry. We also tried to fit human culture into industry, and you may know the artworks of people as cogs in machines and so forth. The idea of the farm as a factory and of animals and plants as units of production that could be bought and sold and manipulated purely for profit became popular. And then we started seeing plant breeding and animal breeding that is more similar to genetic engineering but without moving genes between species. Seeing turkeys that were being bred for their breasts being so large that they couldn't actually get together and mate with each other. They couldn't get close enough to each other, so they had to be artificially inseminated. This is not enhancing the cycle of life of the turkeys. And it's not also, I would argue that the Industrial Revolution has not really enhanced the cycle of life for humans in the long run either. Now, with genetic engineering, we're able to change that relationship so that we are now forcing our desires onto the organisms, and it doesn't matter if it enhances their world or not. So that we can take any gene from any organism on Earth and we can manipulate it and say, we would like that cow now to make human growth hormone, or we would like that petunia plant to make a plastic. And it doesn't matter whether now the cow's offspring can drink that cow's milk. It doesn't matter whether that petunia plant can make seeds that then can go on into the next generation. I would rather have a relationship with an organism as a companion going through evolution together. Rather than being the master of some robot slave. So I urge you to question the basic issues in the science as well as the details. Thank you.
That was Dr. Martha Crouch. She retired from her position as professor of biology at Indiana State University and closed her lab because of her serious concerns about the use made of her research by the biotech industry. Her colleague, Dr. Ricarda Steinbrecher, took a very similar path. She's a biologist and genetic scientist, an outspoken critic of genetic engineering in food and farming. She resigned from her lab, now lives in England, and is the director of EcoNexus. As an advisor to many international organizations, she provides detailed scientific reports on genetic engineering that has gone wrong. You will hear about Roundup-ready soy that becomes brittle in the sun, and petunias engineered for the color red that turn pale because the plant is fighting and silencing the imposed gene. You will also hear about the risks associated with the technique of engineering plants with a virus. Such a procedure might trigger a process called recombination. A living virus is capable of extracting the viral information from the plant and swapping it against its own DNA, thus creating new and totally unknown diseases. Here is Dr. Ricardo Steinbrecher from EcoNexus. Ricardo's first words are directed at Marty Crouch. Dr. Ricardo Steinbrecher.
I remember meeting Marty at the first BioDev conference and how wonderful it felt finding another scientist who also just loved the science of it, or like the curiosity, but also loved life and the organisms, and not just feeling like we have all the rights to just dissect them and change things around, but that there was something we felt needed to be honored, and we both were willing to actually drop our careers for it. What I have been doing in genetic engineering and what I learned has got such a much wider context than I had realized, and that we have so many more questions to deal with than just the so-called sound science. It has emerged to be actually a democracy issue, I mean, which I never dreamt of. In a way, I'd quite like to share with you how it happens that certain plants are allowed to be grown. And I'm coming to an example about soya beans. Ready Roundup, glyphosate resistance, that is, you take that gene, put it into soya. You would expect it would just make the plant herbicide resistant and nothing else, because you've got that gene, and that's a fact, and there's nothing else you put in. What happened is, at one place, it was a hot summer, and all of a sudden, there was quite an infestation of the soya plants by fungi. And some of us thought, well, maybe the defenses of the plants have dropped because of the genetic engineering. What actually happened is that lignin was enhanced 20%. 20% more lignin was produced in those plants. And lignin is the stuff you usually find in trees, you know, which makes wood what it is. Wood, it's a substance which makes the plant wall firm and solid. Now, every small plant might have some of it because it's a strengthening factor, but what happened is that this soya plant all of a sudden produced 20% more, and therefore, when the summer heat came, the plant couldn't adapt quickly enough because it was so rigid and became brittle and cracked open. And this is when the fungi came in. So it was not that the plant all of a sudden, you know, were more susceptible to fungi, but there was a side effect. You have put that gene in that has somehow interfered with another process in the plant. The plant produced more lignin, and the end result was the stems cracked open and the fungi got in. Looking again at facts, when I was working in the human gene area, the idea there was 100 to 150,000 genes in the human genome. And you probably all heard that story, which broke this year when the whole human genome had been sequenced. All of a sudden, there is this idea that there's only 30,000 or 40,000 genes present. 150,000 compared to 30,000 is quite a difference. So it was quite a shock, especially since it only was a few genes more than mice have. You know, and we thought, like, what happened to us? We are so special beings. That can't be true that we only have so few genes. And while some scientists started to explain it one way, which was, okay, if it's true, if we have only so few genes, what obviously must happen is that genes can produce more than one protein. Because if you look at the different proteins we have in the body, it is more than the 30,000, which makes up our complexity. So therefore, they say we need to have a new model, which is that genes produce more than one protein, maybe five, maybe six, we don't know. And somebody else said, no, that can't be, because it's against all the rules, all the knowledge, all the facts we've got. That can't be. But what it must mean is we have more genes, but we can't recognize them yet because we don't know how those genes look like. Now, I've got a problem with both of these, and you might share that afterwards. If we have the situation that one gene is responsible for six or eight proteins, what are we doing with genetic engineering then, if we are transferring genes and we don't really know what they can do? So where is this certainty we have in saying we know what we are doing? But if we say we don't know how genes look like or what else there is about, how can we claim we know how these genes we put in somewhere will interact with the other ones if we don't even know how they work? The knowledge we have in science is just that which we have at that very given moment. You have a year later, and the knowledge has changed. I remember when we said plant genetics was all sealed, and then came all of a sudden gene silencing. The situation in Germany, they had a field with petunia, which were white, but they had genetically engineered them with a gene for red, had tested them in greenhouses, fine, it worked, applied for releasing them in the field, 10,000 petunias were released in the field, and what happened is that all of a sudden petunia leaves started turning pale. Some were pink, some were red originally, and then on the same plant they go white later. And it was really, it was a shock to the scientific community. What had happened? And it was that the gene had been, that the plant itself had started to silence it. And then we have the whole scenario of genetically engineering plants for disease resistance. Disease resistance is fungi, bacteria, viruses, for example. Well, a lot of scientists have actually been jumping up and down about genetically engineering plants with viral genes for a number of reasons. For one, it's, will it work? Then how long will it work? Then will the genes for virus resistance, will they not spread? And what does that mean? And fourthly, can't those genes recombine with viruses? Recombine means a virus has got its own genetic information. If the plant has now also got viral information, the virus can actually take that and swap it against some of its own DNA, so it recombines. For example, it happened in Uganda recently. There was one cassava which was grown in one area, there was a viral attack, in another area was a viral attack, but it wasn't that bad. But what happened all of a sudden, there was a huge epidemic, and there was no resistance anymore, and it really caused a lot of problems for the farmers and for feeding people. And what happened is they realized that strain A from one area and strain B from another area, somewhere they had met in the plant, and recombined and had produced a virus which was really very infective and very effective. So that is very rare, that plants and viruses will recombine. Now, that argument is being used by those who want to produce virus-resistant plants. They say, this viral recombination is so rare, therefore, if we put our plants out there, nothing is really going to happen. Well, that takes one, there's one thing which is not being taken into account in that moment, which is, if I put a plant out there and have put a viral gene or part of a viral gene into that plant already has that gene. It already is something like having been infected by a virus. So if now that plant is being infected by one virus, that already is that situation, which is otherwise described as being rare, which is if two viruses meet in one plant and recombine. Now you have one plant which already has it, recombination is quite easy, and in tests, and this was already found, and viruses, for example, can be then more aggressive, or they can, as was shown also, alter the host range. If they recombine, they might in one moment prefer paprika or peppers, and then in the next moment they go to a different plant, or they change the vehicle how they are transported. They can be transported sometimes by aphids. So if they before then can't be transported by aphids, but now have found that possibility, they can, of course, shuttle between plants. There's a lot of questions. I'm not saying that these things always will happen. What I'm saying is these are possibilities, and we can't say with this certainty that everything is safe. What happens if the gene spreads, like with squash, which has lots of relatives in America? Does it matter if it escapes, if other squash has it? It's virus resistance. Well, viruses, you have to understand in the same context of everything else, is part of an ecosystem. And viruses sometimes also have a role to play, which is keeping certain plants in check. Or like pests have that, you know, that basically weaker plants are often more easily infected and they will die, and therefore like the plants which are healthy have more light to grow. So viruses are just part of that system. And if it spreads, what if it goes to plants which are weeds, which until then had been kept in check through viruses, and now that is gone? What I'm saying is here, we are disturbing a balance which has been there before, but we already started disturbing that balance very strongly with the industrial agriculture we have. That is why we often need that now, because in a way, this might be one of the main points in that is we have to look at need first. What is the problem? Huge crops are infected by pests. Or there's all these weeds, big problem. What do we do? So what is the cause for it? And a lot of times it is the big monocultures. Of course, if you have one field full of the same crop, it's just saying to pests, hello, party, food, and that's exactly what happens. In that context, there might be other mechanisms, which is maybe we should change how big we have the fields. Intercropping is done in a lot of ways. I mean, there's other ways to go about it, rather than find a techno fix, which actually, at the end of the day, will just work for a certain amount of time, and then we have to find a new solution again. Except in this case, we will have released a lot of genes which are out there, and we can't call back, and therefore we will have actually caused a new problem on top of it. So we have not just a technology fix which might fail at the end, so be it, but we have caused a new problem. And I think this is why we really need to pre-think whether we are going to accept further releases into the environment or also into the food chain. There is no independent proper assessments being done. And in a lot of cases, we have a situation that is only done because it's possible, not because it's needed. And the question is for me, should we be allowed to do things just because they are possible? Shouldn't be there a mechanism which checks whether something actually should rather not be done? And in a case when we have so little knowledge and things are still so unpredictable, I think we even have an obligation to say, stop right here and don't pose any further risks, because it's not just our lives we are gambling with, it's the whole future. Thank you.
That was Dr. Ricarda Steinbrecher, former genetic engineer, now living in England. She and Martha Crouch gave up their careers in science to warn us of the physical and philosophical consequences of genetic engineering. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on science and genetic engineering on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get a copy of the program on science and genetic engineering by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.